Good evening, folks. This is The Weird Part, and I am your host, Vincent Truewell. This will be episode 63, Back to the Lost and Found, where I will be discussing missing persons. It is a continuance of previous episode, but they're not in a chronological sequential order, so it's not necessary to have listened to the last one to understand this one. I want to be clear that when I'm talking about the topic of missing persons, not everyone I'm discussing will have been found. I call it lost and found, but not all of them have been found. However, none of them have been found dead. And that kind of is something I was addressing in the various biases in the true crime community towards believing everybody's dead. And, you know, frequently people who've gone missing are found dead. And especially if that's unsolved, I do find that interesting. Of course, there should always be a focus on sympathy and empathy for the victims and the survivors. But the ones I find really the cases I find really interesting are when the person is found and they're alive and at least apparently well. That I find really amazing. Those are the interesting cases to me. Again, some of these have not been found, but have not been found dead either. So I'm going to start with something I alluded to at the end of the last episode, a real rabbit hole of a case, and that is the disappearance of Maura Murray. I'll spell out her name. First name, M-A-U-R-A. Last name, M-U-R-R-A-Y. And she disappeared on the evening of February 9th, 2004, after a vehicle accident in New Hampshire, near Woodville, New Hampshire, a village in the town of Haverhill. She, at the time, was about to turn 22, and she was a college student attending Amherst University, and she has never been found. There have been reported sightings of her, but she has never been solidly placed since. Now, there's a ton of speculation, and I could easily spend the next couple of hours just summarizing all the speculation that has surrounded the disappearance of Maura Murray. Some of it very realistic, some of it absolutely ridiculous, some of it just scandalous and purient and mostly made up, and some of it legitimate speculation. But there are very few facts. There are many theories, some of which I will attack. I will not mention anyone by name, nor any book or podcast by title, if I'm going to just tear them apart, because I don't want to make it into that type of thing. But there's been gallons of ink spilled and hours of commentary made about this disappearance without reaching any solid conclusions, because we can't reach any solid conclusions. It is a true, what you might call a bottomless pit of mystery, which is why I find it fascinating, which is why I'm talking about it. So, she was born in 1982 in Hanson, Massachusetts, the fourth child of Frederick Fred and Laurie Murray. And they were a Catholic family. She was quite the track star in high school. And then she went on to West Point, where there's a very strange and kind of odd chapter in her life that takes place at West Point. And I think it's something that should be explored. Oh, just to provide some background, West Point is the U.S. Military Academy. It is a career path to becoming an Army officer. Just taken as a university, it's among the hardest to get into in the United States. You have to be a stellar high school student and usually exceed expectations both academically and athletically, and you have to really be kind of cream of the crop, you might say, to get into West Point. And she did that. She's a highly intelligent person. And she studied chemical engineering there for 3 semesters. And then there was an incident. And it appears that, from what I've been able to determine, she was caught for shoplifting. Very minor misdemeanor at most. But being the U.S. Military Academy, West Point has an extremely strict honor code, and she was not allowed to be a student there any longer. They did not take like legal action against her. She was allowed to resign and transfer to Amherst, and that's how she ended up at Amherst studying nursing. So it's a detail, but one that may be relevant a bit later. While attending Amherst, Marla gets in trouble again. This time, she does a really minor credit card theft, where she uses someone else's credit card to order pizza, and apparently, like a couple different times, orders food on somebody else's card. And it just seems like a bit of a repetition of the West Point incident, that she seems like a person who's willing to do some very minor crimes. Not a real criminal, but just somebody who will, if given the chance, break the rules to a small degree for really minor purposes. Which seems kind of puzzling to me, because it's almost like you're going to commit a crime to get pizza. I mean, it's like the shoplifting. You are going to steal, I've read that it was some makeup from a store. I mean, it just seems like such petty level larceny that it's like, why are you doing this? You have your whole life ahead of you, and you're screwing up over this trivial nonsense. So that's just a factor, but I think it's suggestive of her character, and by no means would I say that, you know, she's a bad person at all, but she's a person who seems to have a kind of self-defeating tendency where she undercuts her own future for trivial reasons. I'm coming to something here. I'm not just blathering, I hope. excuse me. So, but shortly before her disappearance, she's had the credit card theft to order food. The charge was continued in December to be dismissed after 3 months of good behavior. On the evening of February 5th, 2004, while she was on duty at her campus security job, Rory spoke on the phone with her older sister, Kathleen, and discussed Kathleen's relationship problems with her fiancé around 10:30 p.m. while on her shift. Rory reportedly broke down in tears. When her supervisor arrived at her desk, Rory was just completely zoned out, no reaction at all. She was unresponsive. Supervisor escorted Murray back to her dorm around 1:20 a.m. When asked what was wrong, Murray said 2 words, "My sister." The contents of this call remained unknown until 2017, when Kathleen publicly explained the conversation. Kathleen, a recovering alcoholic, had been discharged from rehab clinic that evening, and on the way home, her fiancé took her to a liquor store, which caused her to have an emotional breakdown. So, there was some trauma going on in her life shortly before her disappearance. Not necessarily related, but not necessarily unrelated. On Saturday, February 7th, Murray's father, Fred, arrived at Amherst. He told investigators he and Murray went car shopping that afternoon and later went to dinner with a friend and his daughter. Murray dropped her father off at his motel room and borrowed his Toyota Corolla, returned to campus, and attended a dorm party. She arrived at 10:30 p.m. At 2:30 a.m. on Sunday, February 8th, she left the party. At 3:30 a.m., en route to her father's motel, she struck a guardrail on Route 9 Hadley, causing nearly $10,000 damage to her father's car. The responding officer wrote an accident report, but there was no documentation of field sobriety tests being conducted, and she was not charged with drunk driving. Ray was driven to her father's motel and stayed in his room the rest of the evening. At 4:49 a.m., there was a cell phone call placed to her boyfriend Fred's phone. The participants and content of the phone call are unknown. Later Sunday morning, Fred Murray learned damages to his vehicle would be covered by his auto insurance. He rented a car, dropped Murray off at the university, and departed for Connecticut. At 11:30 that night, Fred called his daughter to remind her to obtain accident forms from the Registry of Motor Vehicles. They agreed to talk again Monday night to discuss the forms and fill out the insurance claim via phone. After midnight on Monday, February 9th, Murray used her personal computer to search MapQuest for directions to the Berkshires and Burlington, Vermont. The first reported contact Murray had with anyone on February 9th was at 1 p.m. when she emailed her boyfriend. "I love you more, Stud. I got your messages, but honestly, I don't feel like talking too much to anyone. I promise to call today, though. Love you more." She also made a phone call inquiring about renting a condo at the same Bartlett, New Hampshire Condo Association with which her family had vacationed in the past. Telephone records indicate the call lasted 3 minutes. The owner did not rent the condo to Murray. At 1:13 p.m., Murray called a fellow nursing student for reasons unknown. On the afternoon of Monday, February 9th, at 1:24 p.m., Murray emailed a work supervisor of the nursing school facility that she would be out of town for a week due to a death in the family. According to her family, the family had not experienced a death. She also said she would contact them when she returned. At 2:05 p.m., Murray called a number which provides recorded information about booking hotels in Stowe, Vermont. The call lasts approximately 5 minutes. At 2:18, she telephoned her boyfriend and left a voice message promising him they would talk later. This call ended after 1 minute. Yeah, she's leaving a voicemail, so yeah. In her car, Murray packed clothing, toiletries, college textbooks, and birth control pills. When her room was searched later, police discovered most of her belongings packed in boxes and the art removed from the walls. It is not clear whether Murray packed them that day. The police at the time said she had packed between Sunday night and Monday morning. On top of the boxes was a printed email to Murray's boyfriend indicating trouble in their relationship. Around 3:30 p.m., she drove off the campus in her black 1996 Saturn sedan. Classes at the university had been canceled that day due to a snowstorm. At 3:40 p.m., Murray withdrew $280 from an ATM. Closed circuit footage showed she was alone. At a nearby liquor store, Murray purchased $40 worth of alcoholic beverages, including Bailey's Irish Cream, Kahlua, vodka, and a box of Franzia wine. As you can tell, the detail level that's gone into researching her disappearance is pretty intense. Okay, people know what she bought at the liquor store the night she disappeared. So yes, at some point in the day, she had picked up accident report forms from the Massachusetts Registry of Motor Vehicles. Murray then left Amherst between 4 and 5 p.m., presumably via Interstate 91 North. She called to check her voicemail at 4:37, the last recorded use of her cell phone. To date, there is no indication she informed anyone of her destination or any evidence that she had chosen one. And that's what can be proven at that point. Nobody knows who who all she talked to and what all she had said. And this being 2004, I think it's relevant to note that there's still payphones around. That was still a thing in a way that it isn't now. Which is not proof that she ever used a payphone, but she certainly could have. Sometime after 7 p.m., a Wood Hill, New Hampshire resident heard a loud thump against her house. Through her window, she could see a car go up against a snowbank along Route 112, some also known as, and now I'm going to massacre this name, Wild Marosuk Road. The car pointed west on the eastbound side of the road. At 7:27, a local woman reported the car accident on the sharp corner of Route 112, adjacent to her home. She telephoned the Grafton County Sheriff's Department at 7:27 p.m. and reported the accident. According to the 911 log, the woman claimed to have seen a man smoking a cigarette inside the car. However, she later stated she had not seen a man nor a person smoking a cigarette, but rather seen what appeared to be a red light glowing from inside the car, which she took to be the burning end of a cigarette, but could have been a light from a cell phone. A passing motorist, a school bus driver who lived nearby, stopped at the scene. They saw the car, as well as the young woman, walking around the vehicle. The school bus driver noticed the young woman was not bleeding or visibly injured, but cold and shivering. He offered to call for help. She asked him not to call the police. One report says she pleaded with him not to call the police and assured him she had already called AAA. AAA has no record of any such calls. Knowing there was no cell reception in the area, the bus driver continued home and called the police. His call was received by the Sheriff's Department at 7:43 p.m. He was unable to see Murray's car while he made the call, but did notice several cars passing the road before the police arrived. Another local resident driving home from work claimed she passed the scene around 7:37 p.m. and saw a police SUV parked face-to-face with Murray's car. She pulled over briefly and did not see anyone inside or outside the cars and decided to continue home. This witness's statement contradicts the official police log, which has Haverhill Police arriving 9 minutes later. According to the official police log, at 7:46 p.m., a Haverhill police officer arrived at the scene, but the woman driver had disappeared. No one was inside or around the car. The car had impacted the tree on the driver's side of the vehicle, severely damaging the left headlight and pushing the car's radiator into the fan, rendering it inoperable. The car's windshield was cracked on the driver's side and both airbags had deployed. The car was locked. Inside and outside the car, he discovered red stains that looked to be red wine. Inside the car, the officer found an empty beer bottle and a packaged box of Franzia wine in the rear seat. In addition, he found a AAA card issued to Murray. Like accident report, forms, gloves, compact discs, makeup, diamond jewelry, driving directions to Burlington, Vermont, Murray's favorite stuffed animal, and Not Without Peril, a book about mountain climbing in the White Mountains. Missing were Murray's debit card, credit card, cell phone, none of which have been located or used since her appearance. Police later reported some of the bottles of purchased liquor were also missing. Excuse me. Journalist Joe McGee, writing for the Quincy, Massachusetts Patriot Ledger, summarized the incident. At a hairpin turn, she went off the road. Her car hit a tree. At that point, a person came along who was driving a bus. It was a neighbor. He asked her if she needed help. She refused. About 10 minutes later, police showed up to the scene, and Mara Murray was gone. Police traced the vehicle to Murray, and initially treated her as a missing person on the belief she may have wanted to disappear voluntarily. This speculation was based on her travel preparations, about which she had confided nothing to friends or family, and no obvious evidence of foul play. In 2009, Murray's case was given to the New Hampshire Cold Case Division, and authorities are handling it as a suspicious missing persons case. Between 8 and 8:30 p.m., a contractor returning home from Virginia saw a young person moving quickly on foot eastbound on Route 112, about 4 to 5 miles east of where Murray's vehicle was discovered. He noticed the young person was wearing jeans, a dark coat, and a light-colored hood. He did not report it to police immediately due to his own confusion on dates, only discovering 3 months later, when reviewing his work records, that he had spotted the young person the same night Murray disappeared. The responding officer and the bus driver drove around the area searching for Murray. Just before 8, EMS and a fire truck arrived to clear the scene. By 8:49 p.m., the car had been towed to a local garage. About 9:30 p.m., the responding officer left. A rag believed to have been part of Murray's emergency roadside kit was discovered stuffed into the Saturn's muffler pipe. Authorities were referred to Murray simply as missing at 12 p.m. the next day, almost 24 hours after the last confirmed sighting of her. At 12:36 p.m. the following day, February 10th, a BOLO, a Be On the Lookout report, for Murray was issued. He was reported as wearing a dark coat, jeans, and a black backpack. A voicemail was left on Fred Murray's home answering machine at 3:20 p.m. stating their car had been found abandoned. He was working out of state and did not receive this call. At 5 p.m., Murray's older sister contacted her father to tell him of the situation. He then contacted the Haverhill Police Department and was told that if Murray was not reported safe by the following morning, the New Hampshire Fish and Game Department would start a search, which to some might sound peculiar, but if you're looking for somebody in a wilderness area, yeah, game wardens are you would want to do the search. At 5:17 p.m., Murray was first referred to as missing by the Haverhill Police. On February 11th, Murray's father arrived before dawn in Haverhill. At 8 p.m., New Hampshire Fish and Game, the Murrays and others began the search. The police dog tracked the scent from one of Murray's gloves 100 yards east from where the vehicle had been discovered but lost the scent. This suggested to police she left the area in another car. Stick a pin on that one because it's going to be important. The police dog losing the scent suggested to police that she had left the scene in another car. At 5 p.m., Murray's boyfriend and his parents arrived in Haverhill. He was interrogated in private and joined by his parents for questioning. At 7 p.m., the police said they believed Murray came to the area either to run away or to attempt suicide. Her family believed this was unlikely. I would interject here that someone going in some place to commit suicide probably wouldn't pack all of the stuff that she did, including birth control pills, and if they were going somewhere to take their life, they probably wouldn't take their cell phone and credit cards. But that's just my opinion, but that explanation, the suicide explanation, does not make sense to me. Also, that body probably would have been found, if not immediately, then pretty soon. Murray's boyfriend had turned off his cell phone during his flight to Haverhill. At some point, he received a voicemail that he believed was the sound of Murray sobbing. The call was traced to a calling card issued by the American Red Cross. On February 12th, Murray's father and her boyfriend held an evening press conference in Bethlehem, New Hampshire, and the next day, the first press coverage was published. At 3:05 p.m., police reported Murray went beheaded to the the Concomagus Highway area, and that she was listed as endangered and possibly suicidal. The police report also stated Murray was intoxicated at the crash site, although the bus driver had said she did not appear impaired. The Haverhill police chief said that our concern is she's upset or suicidal, which again is possible, but seems far from self-evident by anything that I could see here. A week after Murray's disappearance, her father and boyfriend were interviewed by CNN's American Morning. Murray's family expanded their search into Vermont, dismayed the authorities there had not been informed of her disappearance. Although missing persons cases are normally handled by local and state police, the FBI joined the investigation 10 days after she disappeared. The FBI interviewed family from Massachusetts, and the Haverhill police chief announced that the search was now nationwide. 10 days after her disappearance, New Hampshire Fish and Game conducted a second search, ground and air search, using a helicopter with a thermal imaging camera, tracking dogs and cadaver dogs. Murray's older sister discovered a ripped white pair of women's underwear lying in the snow on a secluded trail near French Pond Road on February 26th, but DNA tests found the underwear did not belong to Murray. At the end of February, the police returned the items found in Murray's car to her family. On March 2nd, family checked out of their motel, exhausted from the search. Fred Murray returned nearly every weekend to continue searching. In April, Haverhill police informed him of complaints of trespassing on private property. So yes, he seems to have been, at least apparently, searching pretty hard. But, again, put a pin in it, is this really searching, or is this making sure that you give the appearance of searching by going on other people's land and getting noticed? Just leave that for further speculation. The March 2004 disappearance of Breonna Maitland in Montgomery, Vermont, 66 miles away from Murray's last sighting in Woodsville, drew comparisons from media and law enforcement due to the similarities of disappearances. However, state police have stated there are no links between the two cases. In April and again in June, New Hampshire and Vermont police dismissed any connection between Murray's case and Maitland's. In a press release, they say they believe Murray was headed for an unknown destination and may have accepted a ride in order to continue to that location, adding that they had discovered no evidence that the crime had been committed. They dismissed the possibility of a serial killer being involved, which I would tend to agree with, and just point out the lack of continued cases of this nature in the area. On July 1st, police retrieved items found in Murray's vehicle from her family for forensic analysis, which it kind of seems like you would have done that before giving them to the family, but that's neither here nor there. On July 13th, a one-mile radius search was performed by nearly 100 searchers, including state troopers, rescue personnel, and volunteers. It was the fourth search around the crash area, and the first search performed without snow on the ground. Authorities were most interested in locating the black backpack Murray had in her possession, but not found in her car. Police stated the search discovered nothing conclusive. In late 2004, a man allegedly gave Murray's father a rusty stained blade that belonged to the man's brother, who had a criminal past and lived less than a mile from where the car was discovered. His brother and his brother's girlfriend were said to have acted strangely after the disappearance. The man's brother claimed he believed the knife had been used to kill Murray. Several days after the knife was given to Murray's father, the man's brother allegedly scrapped his Volvo. Family members of the man who turned in the knife claimed he had made up the story in order to obtain reward money in the investigation, and he had a history of drug use. Again, if you really believed that your brother was the murderer, wouldn't you give the knife to the police and not to the victim's father? That doesn't ring true to me as someone reporting a crime. That rings true to me as something that a meth head would come with as an idea to get money. Just my opinion, just speculation, but that doesn't seem like what someone would do if they wanted to actually report a crime. In 2005, Fred Murray petitioned New Hampshire Governor Craig Benson for help in the search and appeared on the Montel Williams Show to publicize the case. On February 9th, 2005, the first anniversary of Murray's disappearance, a service was held where the car was found, and her father met briefly with New Hampshire Governor John Lynch. In late 2005, Fred Murray filed suit against several law enforcement agencies with the aim of seeing files on the case. On November 1st, 2005, a user named Tom Davies logged into a message board called Not Without Peril that was dedicated to discussion of Murray's disappearance and claimed to have seen a black backpack behind a restroom at... Does anything in New England have a normal name? I'm going to call it the Pemigewasset Overlook, around 30 miles east of Woodsville on Route 112. Murray owned a black backpack, has had a few million other people. But yes, Senior Assistant Attorney General Jeffrey Stretzlin said that law enforcement was aware of the backpack, but did not disclose whether it had taken anything for forensic testing. The New Hampshire League of Investigators, 10 retired police officers and detectives, and the Molly Bish Foundation started working on the case in 2006. Tom Shamshak, a former police chief and a member of the Licensed Private Detectives Association of Massachusetts, said, It appears that this is something beyond a mere missing persons case. Something ominous could have happened here. The Arkansas group, Let's Bring Them Home, offered a $75,000 reward in 2007 for information that could solve her disappearance. In October 2006, volunteers led a two-day search within a few miles of where Murray's car was found. In the closet of an A-frame house, apparently 1 mile from the crash site, cadaver dogs allegedly went, quote-unquote, bonkers, possibly identifying the presence of human remains. Possibly. The house had formerly been the residence of the man implicated by his brother, who had given Fred Murray the rusty knife in 2004. A sample of carpet from the home was sent to the New Hampshire State Police, but the results were never released to the public. In 2008, volunteers led another two-day search through the wooded areas of Haverhill. The group consisted of dog teams and licensed private investigators. Murray's case was one of many cited by proponents of statewide cold case units for New Hampshire in 2009. The case was subsequently added to the newly established cold case unit later that year. In 2010, Fred Murray publicly criticized the police investigation for treating the disappearance of a missing persons case as a missing persons case and not a criminal matter, and called on the FBI to join the investigation, which they already had, but we'll circle back to that. Jeffrey Stretzlin said in February 2009 that the investigation was still active. We don't know if Moore is a victim, but the state is treating it as a potential homicide. It may be a missing persons case, but we're handling it, but it's being handled as a criminal investigation. In 2014, the 10th anniversary of Moore's disappearance, Stretzlin stated that we haven't had any credible sightings of Moore since the night she disappeared. In an article published in the New York Daily News on the 10th anniversary of his daughter's disappearance, it was reported that Fred Murray believed she was dead and had been abducted the night of her disappearance. On February 9th, 2017, the 13th anniversary of Murray's disappearance, Stretzlin wrote in an email to the Boston Globe, "It's still an open case with periods of activity, and at times it goes dormant. There are no updates to share at this time." In February 2019, the 15th anniversary of Murray's disappearance, Fred Murray reiterated his belief that his daughter was dead, as well as his suspicions about the nearby house that cadaver dogs responded to, stating, "That's my daughter, I do believe." In early April, excavations were done within the basement of the house. Fred Murray had previously wanted to search the house, but the owners did not cooperate. Following the sale of the property, its new owners allowed several searches of the property since February. The excavation conducted in early April found absolutely nothing other than what appears to be a piece of pottery or old piping. So there was nothing, no DNA, no blood, nothing. In early 2021, the tree at the site where Murray was last seen, which had been marked with a blue ribbon as a memorial, was cut down by the property owner. Shortly thereafter, a request from Murray's family to have a New Hampshire historical marker placed at the site, which had been submitted in late 2020, was turned down by the New Hampshire Division of Historical Resources. On September 14, 2021, New Hampshire State Police announced that bone fragments had been found at Loon Mountain in Lincoln, New Hampshire. approximately 25 miles east of the site of Murray's crash. In November, it announced that the remains were not of Murray. In January 2022, the FBI issued a national alert in Murray's case and created a violent criminal apprehension profile, allowing multiple law enforcement agencies to share information regarding their case. In July 2022, law enforcement in New Hampshire initiated a search in the towns of Llandaff and Easton. So this continues to be an ongoing investigation at several levels. Murray's disappearance has been cited as the first crime mystery of the social media age and generated speculation from the media and the public, specifically on the internet, in online forums and message boards. Writing for Boston Magazine in 2014, Bill Jensen noted, "Now, at least online, it often seems there's no such thing as a cold case. When Maura Murray disappeared, the social web was in its infancy. There was no YouTube and no Twitter. On the day Murray went missing, Facebook was 5 days old. And so you can read the history of her case as a parable about the evolution of online sleuthing." In 2005, active discussion of Murray's disappearance was documented on websleuths.com. In 2007, Facebook and MySpace pages were created dedicated to helping find her. So yes, just to continue. Continue quoting from Bill Jensen writing in Boston Magazine in 2014. "On the internet, Maura's disappearance is a perfect obsession, a puzzle of clues that offer a tantalizing illusion. If the right armchair detective connects the right dots, maybe the unsolvable can be solved. So every day, the case attracts new recruits, analyzing and dissecting and reconstructing the details of her story with a warring commission-like fervor." Okay, close quote. Okay, so let's get into some of that speculation. There are several prominent theories in the true crime world of what happened to her. Strangely, and I'm mostly here talking about stuff I've read on Reddit, but there's this real contingent of people that believe that she's dead and that she froze to death, that she died of hypothermia. And that, to me, makes no sense because of the repeated searches. If she had ran away, and again, ran away, I presume, but the theory goes that she ran away because she'd been driving drunk and didn't want to get caught by the police for that. Which kind of begs the question, well, how far would she run? She wouldn't run, you know, 10, 20 miles. She'd run probably a few hundred yards and then just hide somewhere until the police left. And if she died of hypothermia, which is possible, there are cases like that, but her body would be found relatively quickly, especially once the snow was gone, and it'd be basically intact, and she'd just be laying there. There wouldn't be search after search after search, finding absolutely nothing. That wouldn't happen like that. But yet, that is an incredibly popular belief on the internet, which seems really morbid to me, that it's like some people, want her to be dead and want a neat and simple explanation of how she died, which defies all the evidence. Somebody who dies of hypothermia, you're not going to have trouble finding the body. It's going to be right there. Usually, you wouldn't even need searchers, just hunters walking around, people camping. Somebody would find that. This is a rural area, but it's not, you know, the middle of the Amazon rainforest. It's a relatively settled area. If she had died of hypothermia, she'd be there. We know that this would have been solved years and years and years ago. I don't accept that theory. I believe it was a very credible theory at the time, like the day it happened or the, you know, the year it happened. But after the repeated searches, I don't think that that's a viable theory anymore. And it, to me, kind of shows a bias in the true crime speculators community that people seem to want her to be dead just so it can be solved. And I don't think that that's the case. I cannot rule out the possibility that she was murdered, possibly by that guy in the A-frame house. The fact that one time cadaver dogs reacted to something is some pretty weak evidence. There have been numerous cases that have come to light where cadaver and other trained police dogs get false positives. That, you know, is not ironclad evidence of anything. And if that's the only thing pointing to that, this guy did some incredible job of covering it up. Because in this day and age, it is really difficult to conceal the evidence of a murder. Especially when there's been significant efforts to find any DNA, blood, hair, skin, anything, and nothing's been found. So the dogs acted up one time, plus nothing doesn't really seem to me to suggest a murder. And I don't remember, this would have to be a very spur of the moment. It's not like he would have tracked her there. You know, it's not, this is not Israel Keyes laying out a kill kit a year in advance. It's not like that. This would be a crime of opportunity where he happens to see, he presumably, it was a guy, I don't know. I'm not naming any suspects because I don't believe there are any credible suspects. But the killer, if she was in fact killed, would have had to just come upon her and make a split-second decision to murder her, to abduct her, and then murder her. And yet somehow completely get rid of all the evidence. And that's damned hard to do and very unlikely. It would be hard enough in today's forensic investigation world to get away with a cleverly planned, premeditated murder. Getting away with a spur of the moment one seems almost impossible when there's been enough police resources expended on it, which in this case there has. There's been a ton of it. There are unsolved murders, but they're usually murders that haven't been very thoroughly investigated. This has been investigated to pieces, and there's no evidence that any crime occurred. What there does seem to be, to me, is a suggestion, based on the totality of the circumstances, that she was picked up in another vehicle. And the most likely, now, I'm very cautious about using the term most likely, because that just means it's most likely. It doesn't mean what happened. I can get on a whole soapbox about why Occam's razor is worthless when it comes to evaluating human behavior, but that's for another time. The theory that makes the most sense to me is that she was picked up by another vehicle, but that vehicle was not somebody picking up a hitchhiker, but rather a planned event that, and this is called in some circles the tandem car theory, that there were two vehicles and one was following her, and when she wiped out, which was an accident, or perhaps it wasn't quite so much an accident and was meant to abandon her car there, there was somebody right behind her to pick her up, and then they took off. And that would explain an awfully lot. Also, I'd like to just address the behavior of her father. And without making any accusations, I don't believe Fred Murray is a bad person at all. His behavior, however, is rather puzzling and, to me, suggestive in a certain direction. And again, this is pure speculation. It's just some guy with a podcast. I am not making any legal allegations against Mr. Murray. I'm not accusing him of anything. Just speculating here. Just talking. But his behavior, to me, seems very calculated. And it seems as though he, and this is my theory, this is what I believe, for what it's worth, I believe that he wanted his daughter wanted to leave and start a new life, and he wanted to assist her in doing that. And so his actions and words all tend to help her stay gone. And I believe that she's alive and well and living in Quebec, Canada, where there have been sightings of her. Obviously nothing conclusive, but that theory makes the most sense to me. His actions seem very performative. The getting reported for trespassing, because he's searching so hard to find his daughter. The statement that he believes she's dead. Well, that's all seems calculated to basically tell the police, you can stop looking so hard. She's dead. And at the same time, he keeps demanding investigations. Even when, you know, there already have been investigations and they haven't found anything. Then, and he has, and to go into some detail that wasn't mentioned previously, he has very strange interactions with the police. He'll loudly demand an investigation. And then when they agree to do an investigation, he'll fail to cooperate at all. You know, do the absolute minimum. Take months to show up for an interview. Not really say anything of any value. And in a strange little twist, he knew about the sock in the tailpipe before the police told him, which just seems really weird if he didn't know anything that she was going to leave or that she might do something like that. Also goes on to demand an investigation, and then once the police are doing an investigation, sue the police department. Which seems completely counterproductive, because I can tell you firsthand, you're not going to get a whole lot of assistance from a police agency that you have an open lawsuit against. You know, he seems to be protesting too much, you might say. Demanding an investigation, and then not really wanting one, and then suing the police department for not doing enough, but not really doing anything to assist them. I think that he knows, at least generally, where she is, maybe even specifically, but he knows where she is, and knows that she's okay, and wants the investigation to go off on wild goose chases, but not to actually find her. That is what I believe. And I would point out that she wouldn't be under investigation for anything I've been able to uncover at all. She would not be under investigation in Canada. So she could move about freely, live her life, and start a new life. And I think that's what she did. I think she did it successfully. And I think she did it with significant assistance from her father, who had just seen her a couple of days before she disappeared. And, you know, there's a ton of detail in this type of stuff, but it just seems as though she would want to have wanted to disappear and start a new life. She had that self-sabotaging behavior in the past, where she'd get started on something really good and then mess it up with some minor offense. And it seemed like she wanted a chance to start with a clean slate and restart her life elsewhere. And that's what I believe happened. of course, that's pretty sunny and optimistic for the true crime crowd. So there are other theories. I will go into some of them, and some of them are dumb, okay? Some people, who shall remain nameless, have come up with the idea that she was murdered by the police because, and I've heard it both ways, that she witnessed the police chief and or the sheriff driving drunk. And I can just tell you, having worked in law enforcement and having grown up in a small town, that didn't happen like that. Okay? So she saw, let's say she saw the sheriff driving around in his squad car drunk. Who the hell cares? She's some out-of-towner who would simply be told, shut up, you didn't see anything, get out of here. That'd be it. Why would you commit this big conspiracy to commit murder to avoid what? A public scandal for drunk driving? That doesn't make any sense at all. But it's been repeated. You can easily find people who definitely advocate for that. And it just seems absolutely absurd to me, you know, that the police would murder this young woman because she saw something, and what she saw was just the police chief liquored up driving a car. That just would not happen that way. Okay. I'll dismiss that. There's also theories, you know, that she was murdered, that a serial killer did it. Again, there's no evidence of that. And the ever-present, she died of exposure. And what bothers me about that, beyond the complete lack of evidence, is the rather snarky, I'm smarter than everybody attitude that the people who advocate that, not all of them, but a fair share, do try to sound like the smartest person in the room. Well, obviously this happened. Well, it's not obvious. If it was obvious, we'd have her body and, you know, this would be a solved mystery many years ago. So yes, people disappearing and starting a new life is rare, but it is certainly something that happens. So we're going to leave the case of Maura Murray at that. Obviously, I can't prove that, but nobody else can prove anything else, so it remains unsolved. So, from there, I want to segue into a case that also took place in 2004, and that is the case of a man referred to as Benjamin Kyle. In August 31st, 2004, he was found naked and injured without any possessions or identification next to a dumpster behind a Burger King restaurant in Richmond Hill, Georgia. Between 2004 and 2015, neither he nor the authorities determined his identity or background despite searches that include television, publicity, and various other methods. So here's one where we have the guy, he's alive. Not in the best condition, but he is definitely alive, but has no idea who he is. On August 31st, 2004, at 5 a.m., a Burger King employee found Kyle unconscious, naked, and sunburned behind the dumpster of the restaurant. He had three impressions in his skull that appeared to have been caused by blunt force trauma, and he also had red ant bites on his body. After discovering him, employees called the emergency services and EMS took him to St. Joseph's Chandler Hospital in Savannah. He had no identity document and was recorded in hospital records as Burger King Doe. After the incident, no criminal investigations were opened by Richmond Hill Police until a friend inquired with the department in 2007. So he was just hanging around for 3 years with no investigation being done. There were no reports of stolen vehicles in the area, and local restaurants and hotels did not encounter any individuals matching Kyle's description. 2 weeks later, he was transferred to Memorial Health University Medical Center, where records state he was semi-conscious. He eventually said he remembered his name as Benjamin, spelled with two A's, but said he could not recall his last name. He came up with the surname Kyle after his police and hospital placeholder name. He had cataracts in both eyes and had corrective surgery 9 months after he was found, when a charity raised enough money to pay for the operation. Upon seeing himself in the mirror for the first time, Kyle realized he's around 20 years older than he thought he was. Kyle believed he was passing through Richmond Hill, either on U.S. Route 17 or Interstate 95 in late August 2004. He may also have been on the road because of Hurricane Charley, which hit earlier that month. After being released from the hospital, Kyle spent several years between the Grace House Men's Shelter and hospitals. In 2007, while at the J.C. Lewis Healthcare Center, he met a nurse who first inquired about his past. The nurse helped Kyle financially, while he earned about $100 a month, mostly doing yard work. While driving his truck in a yard, Kyle discovered that he still remembered how to drive a car. He was diagnosed with dissociative amnesia in 2007 by Jason A. King in Atlanta. Georgia Legal Services did not obtain medical records for Kyle because Memorial Health requested an $800 fee. The American healthcare system strikes again. A friend contacted Georgia Congressman Jack Kingston for help with the case. To help with Kyle's identification, Kingston's office sent DNA samples to the FBI's National Criminal Justice Information Services Division in West Virginia. In March 2011, Kyle was approached by Florida State University's College of Motion Picture Arts graduate student John Wickstrom. Kyle moved to Jacksonville, Florida, traveling on foot, in order to be filmed for a documentary. In 2011, with help from Florida State Representative Mike Weinstein, Kyle obtained a legal government-issued Florida Legacy ID. Kyle's story appeared in a report on News 4 JAX, which caught the attention of the local business owner, who subsequently employed Kyle as a dishwasher. As of 2015, he lived in Jacksonville Beach, Florida, in a 5-by-8-foot air-conditioned shack provided by a benefactor. Many years after his amnesia, Kyle was homeless and been unable to obtain employment as he could not remember his full Social Security number. Several online petitions were created asking lawmakers to grant Kyle a new Social Security number. In 2012, an online petition was created by We the People, petitioning system on whitehouse.gov, but when its deadline expired on Christmas Day, it had received only 2/3 of the number of signatures required. So in other words, the effort failed. In February 2015, a forensic genealogist, Colleen Fitzpatrick, reported that Kyle had cut off all contact with her just as she felt she was nearing a breakthrough. Which is interesting. What it proves, I do not know, but a DNA test revealed that Kyle shared significant amounts of DNA with a family named Powell in Western Carolinas, the descendants of a 19th century man named Abraham Lovely Powell. So that's the power of forensic genealogy. With the DNA testing available today, literally almost anyone could be identified. On September 16, 2015, Kyle announced his real identity had been found, including identifying his name and close family members. There were a number of major efforts to identify Kyle by matching his fingerprints or DNA with those stored in various databases. These included fingerprint comparison to the FBI's National Crime Information Center database for anyone that's ever been arrested, a fingerprint comparison to databases for military personnel and government workers, a DNA test through the Center for Human Identification at the University of North Texas Health Science Center in Fort Worth, a DNA search for genetic genealogies through Family Tree DNA in Houston, searches on DNA databases such as ybase.org, ysearch.org. There are several. Facial recognition comparison by the Indiana Bureau of Motor Vehicles, with individuals who obtained an Indiana driver's license there since 1998. Research of the birth announcements published in Indiana hospitals around the time of Kyle's remembered birth date. In July 2009, a search was made through the Department of Veterans Affairs for Kyle's Vietnam draft registration based on his birth date and physical characteristics. Newspaper articles were published in the Boulder Daily Camera in 2009 and the Denver Post on July 7, 2009, based on Kyle's memories of the University of Colorado at Boulder campus. It was hoped that someone would respond to the articles remembering him from that time. And they go on to discuss the numerous DNA tests that he had taken, which had not successfully identified. Let me just pause for a moment. At some point in the search for his identity, Kyle got involved with hypnotic regression, which is certainly a very controversial, at best, practice. Simply for the reason that it can easily generate false memories. And for someone who's trying to determine his identity, it's questionable how valuable it actually was. But he was hypnotically regressed, recalled a partial social security number consistent with numbers issued in the Midwest. Hypnosis suggested that Kyle had two or three brothers whose names or faces he did not remember, but otherwise he could not recall any other people from his life. Kyle had memories of Indianapolis as a child, including the Soldiers and Sailors Movement, the Woolworths on the Circle, the Indiana Theater showing movies and cinemas. He remembered the Crown Hill Cemetery, the lad's name, Scottish Rite Cathedral, and the White River. He also remembered grilled cheese sandwiches for a quarter and glasses of milk for a nickel at the Indiana State Fair. Based on his reactions to the mention of nuns during hypnosis, he may have been raised Catholic and may have attended Catholic schools. Searching through an Indianapolis high school yearbook, records came up empty, although records from that era are often incomplete. More specific memories placed him in Indianapolis between at least 1954 and 1963. He remembered things that were built and things that did not remember things that had not been built yet at that time. Kyle also had memories of being in the Denver metropolitan area. He had detailed memories of subscription at the University of Colorado Boulder's North Library. More specific memories of Boulder placed Kyle there between 1976 and 1983. The earlier date was based on his memory that he arrived during construction of the Pearl Street Mall in the downtown area, and shortly after the Big Thompson Canyon flood that occurred on July 31st to August 1st, 1976. The later date was based on the year that the King Soopers grocery store chain merged with Kroger. Kyle had detailed knowledge of restaurant management and food preparation equipment, leading to the theory that he may have once worked in these industries. Kyle had nearly no memory of his life after the 80s, including how he ended up in Georgia. One event he does recall is reading about the September 11th attacks. When asked by doctors to recall the presence of the United States, he could only recall those from the 20th century. Many of his memories he cannot describe in words, but feel that they're at the tip of his tongue. On September 16th, 2015, Kyle announced on his Facebook page that his identity had been established by a team of adoption researchers led by C.C. Moore. "A little more than 2 months ago," this is to quote him, "I was informed by C.C. Moore that they had established my identity using DNA. Many people have shared their DNA profiles, so they may be compared with mine. Through a process of elimination, they determined my ancestral bloodline and who my relatives were. The DNA test taken by a close relative confirmed that we are related," Kyle wrote. The Orlando Sentinel reported on September 22nd that, this is of 2015, that Kyle had received a Florida verification card with the help of iDignity, an Orlando-based organization that helps the homeless and others obtain ID documents. iDignity also assisted in establishing Kyle's identification. Kyle's true identity was revealed to be William Burgess Powell. He was born on August 29, 1948 in Lafayette, Indiana, and raised there. In 1976, he had cut ties with his family and abandoned his possessions, including his car and the trailer where he had been living. His family filed a missing persons report at the time, and police found he had moved to Boulder, Colorado, where he had moved on a whim with a co-worker. His birth date turned out to be one of the details about his previous life that he had remembered correctly. A reporter found some social security records for him working in various jobs until 1983, after which no records could be found for the remaining period of more than 20 years before his discovery in 2004, his discovery laying naked behind the Burger King. Kyle appeared on the Dr. Phil show on October 16, 2008, episode Who Am I?, where Dr. Phil paid for Kyle to see a professional hypnotist. Kyle says he was met with skepticism about the case, and there is plenty of room for skepticism, but I'll elaborate on why I think this was completely real. In March 2011, Kyle was the subject of student documentary by filmmaker John Wickstrom, which we mentioned. The film, entitled Finding Benjamin, was in part a description of the various circumstances, in part an appeal for action for local media groups and politicians. The film was invited to be shown at the Tribeca Film Festival and the American Pavilion of the Cannes Film Festival. Although through the outreach involved with the film, Kent Justice of News4JX ran a series on Kyle with the help of Florida Senator Mike Weinstein. Although Weinstein and the Florida Department of Highway Safety and Motor Vehicles, he was able to get the ID card, which we've already discussed. But no leads were developed immediately, but he found work and housing through the generosity of viewers. So this is a case which a person was lost and was found, but there are still many, many unanswered questions. The biggest one, and the one that a lot of people jumped to, was that he was simply faking this entire thing, and that he didn't want to be found by his family, and so he was just lying about not remembering anything. I do not believe that theory for a couple of reasons. One, he didn't make any money off of this. He spent several years being homeless, and I don't know of anybody who concocts a clever plan to be in poverty, okay, to be literally down and out without a car, without a place to live. You know, that doesn't seem like something you do unless possibly you were wanted for a serious crime, but that was thoroughly investigated and he wasn't wanted for anything. What I do believe is that he sustained significant brain damage and really could not remember anything. Well, he could remember some things, but many things he could not remember. I have a personal anecdote that to me confirms that exactly that type of thing happens. I have a family member with whom I have always been close. However, several years ago, and she had been a very successful, you know, highly intelligent person. She was a certified public accountant, ran her own business, did very well. An incident occurred that caused her brain damage. And when I visited her at the hospital, this is several years ago, in fact, I would say this is about a decade ago, So that would make it about 2013. She did not remember anything prior to 2008 and asked me if I was still in the sheriff's department patrolling at the airport. Well, I had transferred from there in 2008, had left the sheriff's department in 2011, and had actually represented her in a case as an attorney, and she had no memory of any of that. I know firsthand that that does occur, and that's absolutely what I think happened to Mr. Kyle. How he ended up nude and beaten, I don't think we'll ever know. And that part remains an unsolved crime. But this is a case where the person was reported missing, was missing for many years, and then was found, and eventually was able to put their life back together. So that's kind of what I mean by the lost and found. So, to go in a shift gears and go in a bit of a different direction, I would strongly suggest that anyone who hasn't seen the series Tiger King should go watch it, because it's absolutely fascinating. And it describes the Tiger King, this man who was trafficking in exotic animals and who went by the name Joe Exotic. His given name is Joseph Maldonado Passage. And he is currently sitting in federal prison for two counts of murder for hire, trying to kill animal rights activist Carol Baskins. But Carol Baskins has a bizarre past too. Her first husband, Don Lewis, is a missing person, apparently. The reason I add the apparently is because Baskin had publicly and repeatedly said that he had been found and was living alive and well living in Costa Rica. And that had been reported in a number of publications, but they were not what you might call hard news. It was reported in Cosmopolitan, for example. But digging around, the best reporting that I could find was in Newsweek, which just said that, well, she stated, they said that my husband Don Lewis is alive and well in Costa Rica. Baskin said during the interview on ITV's This Morning, and yet all this hay has been made about me having something to do with his disappearance, when Homeland Security has known where he is, at least since back then. Some fans of the Netflix documentary have accused Baskin of killing Lewis. A number of theories tying her to his disappearance emerged following the show's debut in 2020. Now, apparently the only evidence that anybody's been able to determine is Carol Baskin saying it. There hasn't been anything definitely reassuring that, you know, confirming that he's actually been found at all. She says that she received a letter from the Hillsborough County Sheriff's Office that informed her that Lewis was currently alive and well in Costa Rica. The letter also claims that Lewis had loaned money to various individuals in Costa Rica and could live quite well on the internet on the interest earned on those loans, allowing him to reside in Costa Rica indefinitely. However, in November 2021, Corporal Moises Garcia of the Hillsborough County Sheriff's Office reportedly said that Baskin repeatedly refused to cooperate with a reopened investigation into Lewis's disappearance. And nothing has, and close quote, nothing has come forward confirming any of her claims. So is Don Lewis lost and found? Or is he still gone? Is he alive? There doesn't seem to be any real evidence to confirm that. And it adds a bizarre twist to what is already quite a twisted tale with Joe Exotic and his attempts to have her killed. It's a wild cast of characters and a fascinating story, whatever the actual truth is. To change from that to someone who definitely was not telling the truth, let me discuss Sherry Papini. She is the woman in California who was allegedly abducted, held captive for 2 weeks, and branded before she was released and able to recall her ordeal to detectives. So she disappeared back in 2016, and she was quote unquote released on Thanksgiving of that month, having been, she stated, held by two Hispanic women who abducted her, held her at gunpoint. Her story began to unravel when investigators found male DNA in her clothing that led back to her ex-boyfriend, whom she had been staying with while she pretended to be missing. He dropped her off along Interstate 5 when she said she wanted to go back home. So yes, she completely faked her own disappearance and then was able to fool the police for several years. But she came up in the news recently after she was released from federal prison, where she was sentenced for mail fraud and lying to a law enforcement officer. The charges didn't stem from faking her abduction, but rather from the lies she continued to tell for years afterward. Fortunately, no innocent people were arrested and sent to prison because she was just lying. The details of how she and her ex-boyfriend concocted this are bizarre in their own right. Investigators said the former boyfriend said that Papini had asked him to hit her, but he refused. Instead, he agreed to hold a hockey stick for her to run into and pelted her with hockey pucks. He also said he branded her at her request. So the brand was real, but yeah, what the hell? You know, why would you go to those lengths to fake a kidnapping and then stick to that story for years? And, you know, I guess I'm kind of stuck on why people would do that, but she apparently had her reasons, and it all ended up being very bad for her. Unfortunately, not for a couple of innocent people who could have gotten railroaded under the wrong circumstances. So we know that people do sometimes fake their disappearance, and sometimes they get caught. I would like to address now the missing 411 work of David Paulides. I know that Paulides has many fans and a fair number of detractors. I don't really want to wade into any of that argumentative stuff. For starters, his background appears to be completely real. He is a retired police officer from San Jose, and so therefore familiar with law enforcement and investigation techniques. And he seems to have a very credible background in things like search and rescue. And I believe that his works have value, and they're certainly not made up. They are a documentation of actual cases of people going missing in the national park system. I will just say that I have two major reservations with his work, which kind of follows, you know, the several books, but they're all kind of about they're real cases. But he seems to kind of suggest that there's a vast conspiracy to cover up people going missing in the national parks. And I don't, you know, I'm a conspiracy guy. I can accept that conspiracies happen. I know that. I just don't see this one as being a conspiracy because I don't see anybody having a motive to do that. Enough people go missing for completely mundane reasons, and many of them die due to the fact that the national parks are vast, just enormous areas, and being in real wilderness, you know, as opposed to some sort of nature trail, this is the real wilderness, and it's very easy to get lost, to get trapped, and to die completely without any foul play or predators or predatory humans being involved. And that, I think, explains the bulk of people going missing. And as far as covering it up, I don't really see that as being what's happening, simply because the National Park Service rangers are law officers, but they're not an investigative organization. They're more a rendering aid organization. The Park Service does not have exclusive jurisdiction over federal lands. My understanding is the FBI would do the investigations if there was evidence of foul play. So the conspiratorial spin that he puts on it, I don't feel is really justified. I don't see who would benefit from covering up that somebody died in the national parks. That doesn't make a lot of sense to me. At the same time, I will give him credit for bringing forward some very fortean events surrounding a lot of disappearances, especially those of children who disappear in one spot and are found in some place they could not possibly have gotten to. That fascinates me. I love that aspect of his work. I just don't think there's a government conspiracy behind it. Also, he has the habit of walking right up to the edge of saying, Bigfoot killed these people, and then not saying it. And he does that, like, quite frequently. And I find that rather annoying that, look, if you're going to say that Sasquatch kills humans, then say that and have something to back that up with. I don't believe that Sasquatch kills people. I just don't think that that's anything not only provable, that there's any evidence of that at all. I think that that's not something that happens. Based on the many, many encounters by people with a Sasquatch that may act intimidating and may scare them, but never physically harms them, that I don't buy that. I don't see where he's getting any evidence for that. Also, he never straight out says it, which maybe there's a reason he doesn't say it, because there's nothing backing that up at all. So that's my take on what he's saying. One of the things I do enjoy that he reports on is people living deep in the national parks who are apparently just regular human beings who wear clothes and, you know, are physically like you and I, except they do kill people, that there are some very disturbed people living deep in the national parks. That I have no doubt about. I have no problem believing that at all. There are in a much less vast and, like, it's right by the road, nature area near where I reside, there are, and I'm not saying they're killers, that's not what I'm saying at all, nobody's missing, nobody's murdered, But there are homeless people who live deep in those woods and have their camp. And not a place that I would really go poking around too much, to be very honest. So the idea that there are people who live deep in the national parks and are completely insane is not a leap of faith for me. That seems like, yeah, that's undoubtedly true, at least sometimes in some places. So yes, I just wanted to mention the missing 411 material because of the crossover with missing people, and in this case, a paranormal explanation, therefore. You know, so yes, that's all I have to say about David Politis, but I have, and I will conclude with one story that is so strange I could not report it, and that is the disappearance of Teresa Beyer in 1987. 16-year-old teenager named Teresa Ann Beyer and a man who was 43 named Russell Welch were camping in California's Sierra Nevada mountain range. This is reported by the Sun newspaper in an article by Mark Hoover. And it's titled, "Did Bigfoot Kidnap a missing California Teenager in 1987? Mark Hoover, writing for the Sun, "Did Bigfoot Kidnap a Missing California Teenager in 1987? And this is a 2020 article. It has not ever been solved. And this is the latest reporting that I could find on it. On June 1st, 1987, a 16-year-old teenager named Teresa Ann Beyer and a man named Russell Welch, 43, went camping in California's Sierra Nevada mountain range. Allegedly, Welch has encountered the legendary Bigfoot creature in the past. After Beyer and Welch entered the mountains, only Welch returned. He claimed to have seen Teresa on June 2nd. He said they both encountered Bigfoot, and Teresa chased after the creature. He didn't see her again. Of course, authorities didn't believe Welch. They launched a comprehensive search into the area where Beyer and Welch allegedly camped. They didn't find Beyer. She had vanished. Authorities arrested Welch on June 11th and charged him with abducting Beyer. However, they couldn't prove Welch had taken her against her will. Some of her friends said Teresa planned to skip school on June 1st and search for Bigfoot. They also found no evidence that Welch had killed Beyer. Although authorities understood the Bigfoot abduction sounded absurd, they dropped the charges against Welch and released him once they uncovered evidence. They could always arrest Welch and prosecute him later. Over 30 years have passed since Beyer vanished in the California wilderness. Authorities still haven't prosecuted anyone for Teresa's disappearance. When authorities looked into Teresa's background, what they found troubled them. She was considered a slow learner and bounced around foster homes for most of her life. She ended up living with an uncle named John Richmond. He was an acquaintance of Russell Welch. Richmond contacted authorities after she didn't return home on June 1st. Today, Teresa Beyer's disappearance remains just as extraordinary as the Bigfoot legend itself. After reviewing various details about this case, I had many questions. For one, why Teresa would be with a 43-year-old man? Supposedly, Welch told Teresa's uncle he would drive her to school. Apparently, this wasn't true, because Teresa informed her friend she planned to skip school with a friend and search for Bigfoot. I also learned that Teresa was gullible. I suppose you give Russell Welch the benefit of the doubt and believe his story. I just cannot believe Teresa chased after a mystical creature. If anything, I do believe it's possible Teresa wandered away and got lost. She probably didn't know the terrain, so this is possible. But I question why Welch would blame the teenager's disappearance on Bigfoot and not just say she wandered off and got lost. A realistic possibility is someone sexually assaulted and murdered Teresa. It's also possible to believe she never made it to the mountains because search dogs didn't locate her body. Over 30 years have passed since Teresa seemingly vanished from the planet. Teresa Beyer's disappearance will always remain a mystery unless someone confesses to harming her or the police prove that a large hairy creature abducted Theresa. My guess is that neither happens. And that was from Mark Hoover. This was reported at the time in the UPI archive. Suspect, quote unquote, Bigfoot did it. A suspect who claims that the legendary ape man Bigfoot abducted a teenage girl was freed from jail 3 days before the scheduled start of his trial on child stealing charges. Fresno County authorities said they're forced to letting Russell Welch, 44, back in the streets to avoid double jeopardy if they later chose to charge the man with murder. Welch is accused of abducting Theresa Ann Byer, 16, last June. Two went camping in the Central Sierra, and the girl did not return. Welch told authorities that the legendary ape man, also known as Sasquatch, had taken the girl. Detectives say Welch apparently sincerely believes in Bigfoot creatures and claims to have continued contact with a tribe of them. Deputy District Attorney Evelice Cooper Friday offered Welch a one-year term on the child-stealing charges if he would sign a waiver allowing for a murder trial in the event the girl's body is found. But Welch's public defender, Miller Rube, refused to sign a waiver and Hooper said he was forced to drop the charge in case authorities later want to charge Welch with murder. If the body is not found, however, Hooper said, he will probably refile the child stealing charges with a maximum penalty of 4 years in prison. Welch had been scheduled to stand trial Monday. Ruby advised his client had anything to do with the girl's disappearance, but would not say if Welch was still contending that Bigfoot took the girl. So that is from October 3rd, 1987, in the UPI archives. And yes, in that entire time, Theresa Byer has never been found, dead or alive, and I have a tough time believing that Bigfoot had anything to do with it, but that's that guy's story. He's never been charged with anything. In fact, he's so out of the news that I can't even determine whether he is dead or alive, dead of old age, you know, or other causes. But there's at least one time that an allegation was made, and the person was never found. So I'll just leave that hang there. Anyway, as always, thank you for listening. This is The Weird Part. I am Vincent Trewell. Good night.